Welcome to the ODI Monthly Podcast, bringing you the views on the news from the Overseas Development Institute. This month, we take a look at the price of rice, discuss why so many refugees are choosing to seek sanctuary in the city, and look ahead to the G20. Rice is eaten by over 3 billion people. It accounts for one-fifth of the calories consumed across the world on a daily basis, and in some Asian countries, such as Cambodia and Bangladesh, that figure leaps as high as 70%. Many of the major rice-producing countries are able to achieve near self-sufficiency when it comes to meeting the demand for rice amongst their own population. This means that the majority of rice grown in the world never makes it onto the world market. But in recent years, the price of rice that has been traded has continued to rise, so much so that it's doubled since 2001. Following the food price spike of 2008, other staple foods such as maize and wheat have fallen back to their pre-spike prices. But the cost of rice has proven more stubborn. So much so that this month ODI released a report into the end of cheap rice. I sat down with one of the report's authors, Steve Wiggins, to take a closer look at the report and to try and identify what higher rice prices might mean for poverty reduction efforts across Asia and Africa. I began by asking an obvious question. Are people eating more rice?
People aren't eating more rice. Indeed, prosperity in Asia is actually seeing rice consumption ahead, actually going down. If you look at the Chinese statistics on this, rural people in China just a few years ago would have been eating 150 kgs of rice a year. That's an awful lot of rice. And today it's below about 100 kgs per person a year. As people get richer, they diversify their diets, they eat more interesting foods. Rice is there, of course it is, but there's lots of other good stuff there as well. So it isn't any increase in consumption.
So, if rice consumption in Asia is falling, why are prices going up?
No, we've had a look at, you know, why the rice price has remained so much higher than what it was only, 2005, 8 years ago. And we think it comes down to two or three factors. Now, some of those factors are temporary changes to markets coming from government policies and circumstances. Just to give you three examples of that, in late 2007, the Indian government banned the exports of cheap rice. Anything but the highest quality basmati couldn't be exported from India. And that was in place through to 2011. And that took India out of the exporting nations, and India is a major exporter and has only recently returned to exporting cheap rice, modest quality rice, in the way that it did in the past. China, alarmed by what happened in 2008, has tried to boost its domestic stores, its publicly held domestic stores of rice. And that's taken rice that might have been exported and attracted a certain amount of imports into China to replace the rice going into store. And last but not least on these temporary factors is the new Thai government, or the Thai government that came in 2 years ago, backed by the farmers. Well, they took a long-standing policy of public guarantees to buying in rice from farmers, but they increased the price at which they would buy in from farmers at well above the world market price. With the result, huge amounts of rice has been taken into public store in Thailand and not exported. And Thailand, of course, in the past was the world's largest rice exporter. And it's lost that position now to the Vietnamese, to the Indians, and so on.
Stocks can only grow so large. If stock increases are temporary, what is it that has really tipped the balance?
What really intrigues us is what we think are structural changes that will last and perhaps increase in the future. And the structural changes is costs of production of rice are going up. Now, some of that may be that as we need more rice in the world, we have to produce rice from lower potential areas. You know, we run out of the easily irrigated, fertile delta lands of Asia, and we move to more marginal production areas, and costs of production go up. But more important than that, we have a rising oil price, and with the oil price goes up the price of nitrogenous fertilizer, goes up the cost of running machinery, so that pushes up production costs. And finally, and most intriguing of all, there has been a dramatic rise in farm wages in some parts of Asia since the mid-2000s. It's particularly notable for both India and China. You know, we're talking about wage rises where over a period of 5 years, we're seeing rural wages going up by 25%, 30% or more. Serious and sustained rises in rural wages. That, of course, is something that pushes up the costs of production of rice, but it's very good news because farm labouring has often been a major form of income for some of the poorest people anywhere in the world.
So potentially good news for those who are working the farm harvesting the rice. Bad news, though, presumably for those who are reliant on cheap rice for the mainstay of their diets.
Yes. Now, who are the people who will really lose out? The first thing we have to note is that in India and China, to a certain extent, we note the same trends in Indonesia, in Thailand, Bangladesh, in other parts of Asia. For those people where jobs are being created and wages are going up, the additional cost of rice will be relatively trivial. A simple calculation says that at most, we're talking about an increase in people's rice bills that may be $3 per week. Now, for anybody with a decent job, which is getting paid better, this is a trivial increase in the cost of living. The worrying thing are those people who live in those lagging parts of Asia, where there are poor people who are not getting the benefits of the industrialization, the new manufacturing jobs, the urbanization, and so on. So we're thinking about dryland India, some parts of the Deccan Plateau of India. We're talking about Western China and such other areas there. We're also talking about those parts of Africa where rice is imported on a large scale and has come to make up a large part of the diet of poor people living in urban areas. And above all, that's coastal West Africa. You know, it's people who are poor living in a city like Dakar, Senegal, who become used to relatively cheap rice from Asia and are seeing the cost of that rice rising. Those are the people who are going to lose out from this.
Is there a role that government should be playing to help people adapt to these increasing prices?
Two things that government should be doing. One is that when you get periods of rapid economic change, such as we're seeing in Asia, some people will always lose out. So you need social protection nets. Now, what is interesting is that in both India and China, the two giants of the continent, we are seeing proliferating social protection schemes. So, for example, in India, employment program called the National Rural Employment Guarantee Program swung into operation in 2007. So nobody who's able to work will be deprived of work at a low basic wage should they wish to go out and work. That is now on statute in India. India is also bringing in at the moment a new food security bill that will subsidise a certain ration of basic foods to a level not previously seen in India. There are worries about how expensive that is, obviously, but it just shows that the governments are taking that kind of social protection very seriously. In China, the provisions of cheap medical care, public employment, and so on have been rolled out and enhanced across China. The qualification level of low income has been raised to bring more people under that social protection. All that has been done in the last 5 years. The Chinese government is very alive to the social implications of this, and for people who are losing out, there is increased public provision to take care of them. So social protection is one thing that is needed to compensate people who lose out from change. Now, coastal West Africa, it's much more difficult for the governments there to come up with such schemes. They're not in prosperous, fastest expanding economies, even if those economies are beginning to grow at rates we haven't seen before, but they're still not at the sorts of levels that we've seen in China and parts of Southeast Asia and so on. The second thing that governments can do, of course, is facilitate adjustment. Now, if you take coastal West Africa, higher world prices of rice are initially, of course, a threat. They're a disadvantage. In the longer run, they're a tremendous stimulus to the farmers of coastal West Africa to produce traditional foods of West Africa, such as cassava, yam, millet, and sorghum, to replace imported rice. There's an obvious market opportunity for substitution. And in those parts of West Africa which are well adapted to producing rice, and remember that some countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, is one of the heartlands of rice production in the world. In those areas, there's a tremendous opportunity to grow rice locally, replace the imports and begin to export to countries like Nigeria.
For now then, the end of cheap rice is a tale of winners and losers. The challenge for governments and others in West Africa in particular is to try and turn it into a win-win situation. Refugees are not a new phenomenon. War has long acted as a driver of migration, forcing people away from their homes and into new areas where they have to try and find a way to exist in an unfamiliar environment with few of the domestic comforts that they may once have known. Despite the progress made in the fight against poverty in recent decades, the number of people categorised as of concern to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has grown by over 14 million worldwide in the last 6 years. This is in part due to new conflicts, but other factors are in play. The average length of displacement has more than doubled to 20 years, and traditional solutions favoured by humanitarian agencies do not appear to be working. Many people's understanding of what it is to be a refugee is based on the proliferation of refugee camps in response to 20th century conflict. Housed by major aid agencies in rows and rows of temporary tents, with food and other supplies only available through handouts. Today's reality is that around half of all of those forced from their homes live in urban areas. The growth in urban refugees has presented a challenge to aid agencies seeking to provide shelter and support to those on the sharp end of conflict and catastrophe. I spoke with Simone Haysom of the Humanitarian Policy Group at ODI and author of the recent Sanctuary in the City series to discuss these difficulties. Much of Simone's work refers to refugees and IDPs, or internally displaced persons. I began by asking her to explain the difference between the two.
In one sense, there's a very clear difference between refugees and IDPs. Refugees are people who've crossed an internationally recognised border, and there's an entirely separate legal framework that applies to them than the one that applies to IDPs, who remain citizens of the country in which they've been displaced. On another level, you'll often hear IDPs referred to even in the media as refugees, because in practice, they're both people who've had to flee their homes due to war or disaster.
So are there significant differences facing refugees and IDPs today compared to 10 or 20 years ago?
In broad brushstrokes, I think you could say the answer to that is yes, but it's quite complicated if you look at the kind of shifts that have occurred. The last few decades of the 20th century, there was a huge predominance of large camp-based responses, which perhaps in part because they were a very good visual shorthand for the effects of war, became very much associated with displacement. And also the places where most NGOs and UNHCR was operating predominantly, and in that way came to be seen as the normal situation for refugees in many parts of the world and IDPs. We've also seen in some parts of the world border control become stricter and resettlement places, particularly in the West, decline, which have all changed the kind of dynamics around who becomes a refugee or who becomes an IDP and where they go and how long they stay there. One of the most significant changes has just been the length of displacement. So someone who was a new refugee in the mid-1990s, who perhaps thought they were going to go back to their home very shortly, is probably still a refugee in places like the countries adjacent to Somalia or Afghanistan.
And which factors have driven the increase in the number of people seeking to live in urban areas?
I think there's several reasons. One of the more interesting dynamics that we've seen in the last few years is that there have been large displacement crises from what were largely middle-income countries, so say Iraq and now Syria. The people leaving those countries are not willing to be housed in camps, do not want to be in them, and the countries receiving them also were very unwilling to establish camps. Whereas a lot of the conflicts that occurred in the 90s, particularly in Africa, people were often fleeing very underdeveloped rural areas. The services that were offered in camps could even have been better than the ones that they had in the place where they fled. So perhaps there was more tolerance of the conditions in them. Those have always been problematic too.
The preference for refugees to live in urban areas has been clearly evident to those working on recent displacement crises in both Lebanon and Burkina Faso. We caught up with two experts at the Humanitarian Policy Group's advanced course in conflict, crisis and transitions. Lina Hamadan is United Nations Development Programme Officer affiliated to the Prime Minister's Office in Lebanon.
I think they prefer living in cities because the camps are overcrowded. In one room, you can find 15 persons in one room in the camp. Basic services are not provided. They don't have enough water, they don't have electricity, they don't have enough space, not to mention the diseases and the lack of medical services. So they prefer going out, hoping to find some job or any kind of living. But it is really difficult, the situation. And it's clear when you walk in Beirut, you find a lot of beggars. We didn't have this 2 years ago. This is a new phenomenon.
Tidiane Udrego is currently studying conflict in his native Burkina Faso at the University of Copenhagen. He agrees.
We have noticed that a lot of people, a lot of Malian refugees, who are not in these camps. They prefer to stay outside the camps, either with friends like myself, either with renting a house to stay. I received a friend with his families. There were 25 people, and they stayed in my house for 2 months. I think they will prefer to stay in cities if they have this opportunity. Because if you are in the camp, it's like, it's look like you are in a prison. There is no privacy. You are, with a lot of people, you cannot really move around freely like you will be in the city. So if there is a possibility, people will stay in the city.
Simone Haysom explains why.
It's easier for agencies to operate and provide those services in camps. I think you can say that. It's easier when you have everyone in the same place and you're given a lot of autonomy and control, which is very crudely how a refugee camp would operate in a number of places, that international organizations or the refugees themselves would be allowed to stay on land temporarily and then external actors would provide services. You can't do that in a city too, because people are dispersed and it's the state's responsibility, and for a whole lot of reasons about the fact that people are not doing temporary services in a city. They're thinking about putting in permanent ones.
But according to Lina Hamadan, it is not just those who might have to live in them that are wary of camps.
There was a proposal to build some camps, but due to the previous experience with the Palestinian refugees, the Lebanese public is reluctant, and there's a resistance among all the Lebanese. They don't want camp because they say if it's temporary, it will become permanent. The local government doesn't have the means. You know, this is not a very rich country. And the help coming from the international community is coming through NGOs, through international organization, UNHCR. There's no real form and mechanism to channel these assistance for the refugees. I think there should be some comprehensive plan to find a way to manage the refugees file, not only in Lebanon, in all host country, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, all the neighboring country. For now, the population is accepting because of the Syrian crisis, but at some point, I think if the crisis will calm down, they will look at the economic situation, and this would be difficult for them. They would see the refugees as a threat.
This concern over the length of time that refugees and IDPs may have to remain with their new hosts, perhaps even becoming permanent, is well recognised. Kabul in Afghanistan quadrupled in size in 10 years, growing from a city of 1 million to over 4 million by 2011. Whilst many of the new residents were nominally entitled to services from the state, in practice they were often denied by a government who promised a return to rural areas was imminent.
I mean, often what you'll hear governments say is that providing services will entrench people's position in the city. So if we give people sanitation, if we build them homes, then they'll never go back. And the best thing for them is to go back. So a number of assumptions about what will make people move or stay, and also about what's best for them, that often lead to services not being provided. I think one of the reasons that governments often take that line is because that kind of rapid growth of the city is very difficult to manage. Administrations are overwhelmed. They are struggling to provide to the existing population and unable to meet the needs of the population that arrives. So displacement can compound governance challenges that cities are already experiencing, lack of resources, chronic underdevelopment for several decades.
It's a complex problem, but there are some signs of hope, even if they don't go quite as far as many would like.
I think, paradoxically, there's been quite promising developments on the policy side, and definitely an increasing amount of attention from both researchers and policymakers in various publications. In 2009, UNHCR released a landmark policy on urban refugees, reversing a position that it had taken in the 90s that said that urban refugees were not in need of assistance or attention, and saying that they were, and it was an important operating environment for the agency. You also had the Interagency Standing Committee release a policy on humanitarian action in in urban areas broadly. I think the level of policy development hasn't been met by innovations in practice or increasing sophistication of the response or adaptation to the situation. So in a number of programming areas which are really vital to really responding to the needs of refugees in urban areas, say protection and livelihoods, you don't see the requisite amount of innovation or adaptation.
The G20 leaders meet in Russia in early September. There's no doubt the G20 is an important forum. Its leaders are responsible for 2/3 of the world population, 80% of global trade, and over 90% of global output. The inclusion of the major emerging economies gives it arguably more potential than its G8 cousin to positively impact the lives of the poor. And the recent London G8 is now cited as having been an important first step towards an agenda that recognises checkbooks alone will not solve the world's shared problems. So it's not immediately obvious as to whether the glass is half empty or half full ahead of the summit. I sat down with Dirk Willem ter Velde, head of the International Economic Development Group at ODI, to discuss what we should expect come early September. I began by asking him whether he agreed that there hadn't been as much progress at recent government get-togethers as we might like, and how he might assess the capacity of the G20 as an effective global body.
Jonathan, I think you're absolutely right. There has been little progress made so far, or at least in the last 10 to 15 years, in global trade rule and environmental rulemaking. But when the G20 was turned into a leaders' meeting around 5 years ago in 2008, it was able to make sure that there was cooperation on economic policies. It was able to mobilize around $1.1 trillion. It was able to combat the worst of the financial crisis and restore some confidence in world markets. And it did this in coordination with emerging markets. So I would say there is some sense that the G20 can play a role globally. More generally, our research has suggested 5 areas where the G20 can make a difference. These are in identifying global governance gaps, providing policy direction. The G20 can put a spotlight on important issues. They can foster knowledge sharing, and they can help to build trust amongst various countries and develop standards. And our research has suggested these are areas where the G20 has helped. But of course, we shouldn't be too optimistic either, because it hasn't worked in all areas all the time. But to take 2 small examples here, did put a spotlight on an issue like inclusive green growth last year when the Mexicans were leading the G20. And it also helped to increase IMF lending quotas back in 2009 and 10. So there are examples where the G20 has helped, but it has also failed in other areas.
So does that mean that the G20 will be taking a leaf out of the G8 book and putting away the checkbook?
I mean, yes, you're absolutely right that there has been a very noticeable change in the G8 development approach. It used to think about reallocating aid towards purposes such as for health and education. But this time, and then the London Summit was very different, and it focused much more on what a G8 can do. It focused on the G8 core policies and also more on economic themes. In this context, we should remember that the G20 has also focused on economic development policy, in particular in its development stream. And for instance, it has had a work stream as part of the development working group on taxation and domestic resource mobilization. And so this is one area where the G8 and the G20 can help each other. And hopefully that we'll see more of this theme coming back at the coming summit and afterwards. But more generally, our research points out that the G20 core policies in areas ranging from trade to financial regulation to tax, environmental, fiscal and monetary policies can have a very big impact on development. And so this is a sort of a beyond aid agenda, and it can be mutually beneficial. It can be good for both the G20 and for developing countries. To mention 2 examples, the first is trade. Here, the EU, the US, the BRICS countries, they could lower their protection worldwide in areas ranging from agriculture to solar panels to garments to services. And in doing so, they can benefit their own consumers, their own retailers, but also developing country exporters. Another example is when the G20 could think about sort of rebalancing of their savings. They should not necessarily only think about reallocating into their own countries or within the G20. They could actually reallocate their savings globally towards the most efficient and the most effective purposes, and this could well include low-income countries where there are some profitable opportunities. And so this is another area where I would say it is not costly for the G20 to do things that are beneficial for development. So it, in some sense, is low-hanging fruit, although it does require some or a lot of negotiations and a lot of discussions.
So if the G20 does possess the capacity to have a significant effect on global development efforts, How do we hold it to account?
I think the G20 is a network of networks, and it calls itself the Premier Forum for International Economic Cooperation. Deliberately doesn't call itself another international institution, and it isn't another international institution. Yet we do want to know what it's doing and whether it is succeeding in what it's doing. Of course, at the moment, we have got a range of think tanks, business and civil society groupings that ensure some sort of accountability already. But in order for the G20 to have more legitimacy, it's got to do more, particularly if its development interventions need to be effective. It needs to be more legitimate. It needs to think more about mutual accountability. In order to do this, we need to have many more discussions between the G20 and governments of low-income countries or developing countries more generally. In terms of accountability of the development agenda, I think there we have already some innovation when it comes to the G20 as opposed to the G8. So when the G20 development agenda was formulated in 2010, it started something called a multi-year action plan. And there it agreed in 2010 a range of actions that would be beneficial for development. And these are publicly available, all these actions, and we can actually assess them. We can assess whether they have been undertaken. And we've actually looked into this a couple of months ago, and our conclusion was that in some areas it has undertaken a range of useful actions for development. In other areas, well, less progress has been made. But it is an example where we can hold the G20 to account and need to see much more of this, and we need to see many more discussions amongst the G20 and developing country governments about actions that the G20 can do to benefit developing countries.
There is some feeling that the poorest developing countries, particularly African countries, are unfairly left out of the G20 process. In many people's eyes, it is a forum for the wealthy, not for the poor. I asked Dirk if he thought that was a fair assessment.
Well, it depends a bit on what it's doing. And I think that the G20 can be good for both richer countries and poorer countries. And if it puts its own house in order, the G20 can raise its own growth rates and at the same time narrow the development gap. And that's sort of the narrative behind the whole development agenda at the G20. Which is sort of the narrowing the development gap. And I think that G20 can be very helpful in doing. Now, you asked also about representation. And of course, we have at the moment representation of the various developing country groupings or regions in each G20 summit. But it's more or less at a sort of an ad hoc basis. And what we don't see, and what I'm actually more concerned about, is that there aren't any regular feedback meetings between the G20 and developing country ministers on certain issues. So, for example, there aren't any feedback meetings where the G20 are held accountable to developing country governments for their actions, and vice versa. There aren't that many meetings where the developing country governments can put agenda items on the agenda of the G20.
And finally, how should we judge the success, or otherwise, of this year's summit?
I think my main expectation for the upcoming summit is that there will be credible G20 and development outlook, which combines the best of the G20's core areas and the interest of developing countries. And here I mean there will be discussions about how in the future the G20 can ensure a development-friendly global rebalancing of international savings, how the G20 can put in place development-friendly core policies in the area of tax, trade, finance and environment, so that can help developing countries. So in that sense, it should continue a move towards a beyond aid agenda, so where the G20's core policies can make a very useful contribution to development. So in that sense, what I'm hoping is that there's going to be a much better integration of three of the G20's work streams. And these are, first of all, work stream on strong, sustainable and balanced growth. The second is on financing for investment. And the third one is on development. And I would hope that these three, if you lock them together, that could help both the G20 countries and developing countries. So if we can see this locking together of the development and core G20 policies much more in the future, that will be very, very useful. So I hope that that's what we're going to get in the upcoming summit in St. Petersburg in Russia.
Thank you for listening to the ODI Monthly Podcast. If you want more information on the topics discussed in this month's podcast, you can take a look at the related links section of the ODI Podcast webpage. If you want to get in touch, drop us a line on media@odi.org.uk. If you've enjoyed listening, why not subscribe to the monthly podcast using iTunes or Audioboo? Thanks for listening.